Okay, and we are recording. And I'm delighted to have with me today Drs. Jen and David Unwin, two of my heroes and pioneers when it comes to communicating the benefits of changing how you eat to benefit your health. So welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks so much for coming on. I'm sure most people listening will know who you are, but it'd be great if you could maybe just talk about your backgrounds, each of you, and how you arrived to where you are just now.
Shall I go?
Yes, you first.
So I'm a clinical psychologist by background. I've worked in the NHS for over 32 years and just recently retired, helping people with chronic health conditions generally, really, to live as well as they could, or, you know, people who was maybe struggling emotionally or mentally with something like chronic pain or disfigurement or other chronic conditions, obviously like diabetes and that kind of thing, helping them to live as well as they could. And I was a big fan of working with people in groups. I found that an incredibly sort of powerful and effective way for people to help each other, really. And so how did I come to all this? So also lifelong sugar addict, struggled all my life with those the thorny issues of weight and what to eat and trying not to eat and then overeating and all of that. And I stumbled across a book. It's a bit cheesy, isn't it, when people say this book changed my life, but it kind of changed both our lives. So Dr. John Briffer, who is a British GP, and I think the book's still in print, Escape the Diet Trap, stumbled across it in the supermarket one January when I'd had a particularly woeful Christmas of eating and read this book and was reading bits out to David, and it made total sense. And actually what it was a written for the public kind of tome about low carb and the science of low carb and some kind of advice about how to get going and the difference it had made in his life. So so I thought, right, I'm going to have a go. Tried everything else under the sun. I'm going to have a go. And went both feet first, cold turkey into it, and felt terrible for about 8 days. But then this kind of like in Disney, the lights came on and I felt amazing. And David kind of witnessed that transformation. And then following after that, one or two other things happened and we had some conversations about maybe getting going with a joint project and working with people with diabetes in his practice. But it started at that point, really, of having experienced the benefits of it myself, of this kind of low carb, real food lifestyle. So I'll let you say.
I think for me, It's a lifelong interest in what makes a difference. And I remember when I very first qualified at Liverpool University years and years ago, and there was a big thing about what sort of a doctor did I want to be? And I decided that I wanted to be a big fish in a little pond. And I picked the tiniest pond I could, which was Southport, which nobody's ever heard of. And here I am, as a big fish in a tiny pond. And that was because I thought it'd be lovely to be part of a community where continuity with my patients would grow and make me more effective as a doctor. And that's been such a gift, such a wonderful gift. So I've looked after the same patients now in Southport since 1986. And I think that in a way laid the foundation for both of us, because when we came to have our epiphany, I had, as it were, the most wonderful group of patients. I was already trusted.
Yeah.
And by then I was senior partner as well. So I'd become a very big fish in a tiny pond. And it allowed us to do something experimental in a trusting environment against this backdrop of wishing to be effective and what makes a difference to patients. Mm. The other thing I'd come to notice since 1986, I was a very slow learner indeed. I'd noticed by about 2012 that we were hardly ever thinking about the true cause of illness. So we're all sort of familiar with probably a bacteria causes pneumonia and antibiotics is a reasonable cause. So that you found the true cause and antibiotics kill bacteria, so you've done a good job. But what about so many other conditions like essential hypertension? What about type 2 diabetes? What about eczema? Lots of conditions that I was using drugs for without a moment's thought as to the true cause of those illnesses. So it's slightly worrying that as a doctor, I was quite content to give a great deal of medication when I didn't even understand what the cause of the illness was. How can you treat an illness that you don't know what the cause is? And I realized that what I was actually doing for many illnesses was controlling, just stopping it being too bad, a sort of sticking plaster, using the drugs to kind of control it. But as a form of medicine, it was deeply unrewarding because the patients never looked well. They didn't look properly well. And then when Jen and I did our first group work, which was low carb with people with type 2 diabetes.
We were actually a bit cowardly.
We were cowardly, yeah.
We didn't know how controversial it was going to be. We hadn't seen it done before. What we were proposing, which was to help people with their what they were eating in a group setting in primary care. So we wrote to all the pre-diabetics.
That's actually it's true. So we were too frightened even to do it with people with type 2 diabetes, which sounds amazing now, but actually in 2012, for instance, my partners hated what we were doing. They were deeply worried by it. And so we were right to be cautious.
We had a dietitian who just left for practice.
Yes. So we did have a really lovely dietitian who helped us, and her boss pulled her out of the practice. And in fact, my practice has never had a dietitian ever again, which is such a shame because she believed in what we were doing. So anyway, let's be honest. Yes, we started with the pre-diabetics because I was too much of a wuss. But in amongst them was a single diabetic, person with type 2 diabetes who snuck in. And he had a dramatic result, didn't he?
Yeah.
He did so well, and we started seeing results.
We got bolder then.
We did. But what we saw, Jen, was that people looked incredible.
Yeah.
That was the thing. I'd not seen, so people who previously had so many different illnesses, high blood pressure, diabetes, all sorts of skin conditions.
A few weeks would come waltzing in with their bright eyes and their bushy tails.
I particularly remember people's eyes are the thing that changes first, wouldn't you say? Yeah. In the first couple of weeks, they come in with bright eyes, and so many of them said, it's so odd, Dr. Omen, because I've got more energy.
I went to walk last night. I haven't done any exercise for years.
Yeah, they say stuff like, I'm a bit bored in the evening, so I've joined a gym. Or, you know, the fascinating aspect of it was not just the condition diabetes, but all the other things that they were telling us about: skin condition, energy, sleep quality. And in fact, here's the thing, is that the results were so good, I didn't dare tell people because I thought they would think we were a fraud. Because normally if you collect data and look at results, you might get 5% improvement. But our results were way better than that. On average, they were losing 9 kilos. They were losing 10% of their body weight. The blood pressure was improving, the lipid profiles, the liver, everything was improving. Mm. When I collected the data, all my friends would just think that we were phonies. Mm-hmm. And at this point, some of the people here will have heard of Roy Taylor, a famous professor at Newcastle University. And I wrote to a lot of academics about our results, saying we feel we ought to tell the world because they're so amazing, but we don't know how to do it. And Roy Taylor, what a saint, he's so busy, but he actually did the stats on our first ever published paper. He did them himself and helped us get published. And that gave us credibility that we weren't lying. And it kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, I think it was the first sort of UK data that came in primary care.
It was only on.
So, and again, we had no idea what we were getting into at the beginning. No. Suddenly people are kind of interested in what you're doing. And I think because there was a sort of a growing interest perhaps in the diabetes community, thanks to diabetes.co.uk and other sort of about this kind of work, but there wasn't really any sort of legitimate, you know, there wasn't anything to back it up. It was a sort of secret society of people doing it for themselves and perhaps getting told off by their GPs. So there was a lot of interest then in what we were doing. And so obviously, I mean, we carried on anyway because of it's fun and the results that people were getting. And obviously there's been more data and the data's been growing since, for 9 years now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, since the beginning. So the original paper was only on 18 people.
And what year was that?
That was, we published in 2014 and the data was collected in 2013. And it was only on 18 people. But what amazed me...
This first group that we sort of set off with.
Yeah, but what amazed me was that we got such kind of heat in that it made some people really cross.
Yeah.
I was so mystified. I got hate mail. I got hate email. And all we'd done, just a quiet couple had done some good for 18 people. And yet it really upset people, some people, and others were cheering. And when we first did it, we didn't know any other clinicians doing low carb work. We didn't, did we? No, we didn't know a single person.
Not in the UK, no.
So it did lots of good things and some frightening things. But what it did teach me, which was really useful, is if you're going to do something weird and not conventional, collect data. And this is difficult for clinicians because we're not used to audit, really, and we're not used to it. But collecting data, if you collect data, then you get taken seriously. And so the fact we were under threat right from the beginning, which we were, was great because it scared me into learning. I remember too, Prof Taylor said, you need to do an Excel spreadsheet, but I didn't even know how to do that. So I had to get my accountant, a trainee accountant, a teenager. I offered him 10 quid an hour and he did the first Excel spreadsheet that I loaded all it on. And we're still using the Excel spreadsheets now, but I think we've gone from data on 18 to data on over 300 patients. So funny in life, sometimes your enemies do you a wonderful favor because they made us careful and made us thorough.
And the other amazing thing about the data, the length of time. So some of those original 18 are still, quite a few of them obviously are still in the data set and are still doing incredibly well. So one by one, we've been able to knock down those criticisms that people make of low carbon keto when they say, well, people can't, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, that's right.
That's always trust. It's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
We've been doing it for 9 years, and all these patients as well are still doing incredibly well. They're still in remission. They're still off the medication. You know, you'd expect people to get worse, if anything. That's what used to happen, but they haven't. They've all maintained or carried on improving over years. We've had people who've lost weight. We've had people now lost 9 stone, you know, slowly over the years. They've kind of they've transformed their lives. So there's it's not sustainable.
Next one, let me do the next one.
Okay, you do that.
So there was they'll never sustain it. The next one was the cholesterol will go through the roof because we've got them all on eggs, cheese, and full fat dairy. And it was amazing. So last year we published a paper with the data on lipid, not just cholesterol, but the full lipid profiles. And I just couldn't get over it because the cholesterol's improve, the HDL improves, the triglyceride improves by 30 to 40%. The HDL goes up, the lipid profile. So that was the second thing that according to our patients and our data, despite all the full fat dairy and the eggs and the cheese and the steak and all the rest of it, the lipid profiles actually improved. What's the next one then, Jen?
Blood pressure, you know, because we don't, other people don't limit salt, and they don't limit saturated fat. The blood pressures improve, and they patients coming off medications.
Yes, 20% of all the people who were on blood pressure have come off medication now out of the group, have come off drugs for high blood pressure. And even despite that, we're still getting significant improvements in blood pressure. I'm going to ask you a question now.
Oh, the tables are turned.
Let's turn the tables, yeah. Do you know why is it that a low-carb diet improves blood pressure?
Well, I've certainly heard you say that salt gets the blame for what the sugar did. But maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, I give you a house point. I'll give you a house point for that. Well done. Yeah, so the what happened here was that started with me. So I used to have moderately raised blood pressure, about 160 over 93, something like that. And when I went low carb, I discovered I was having to hang on to the desk as I stood up because I felt dizzy. And I didn't know, I thought maybe it was hypoglycemia or something. I didn't know what it was. But one day I did my blood pressure, and I'd got the blood pressure of a 25-year-old. My blood pressure had improved. And then we noticed with loads of other patients that their people who previously had high blood pressure started feeling dizzy when they stood up. And I was having to stop their BP medication because they didn't need it anymore. And Jen's blood pressure, yours went really low. So Jen went down. It was low anyway, and it went lower, and you had to have lots of extra salt to keep her blood pressure up. And then, so I'd noticed this with so many patients that we'd also noticed, I don't know whether you noticed it, when you first go low carb, you wee loads, you pass lots of urine. I had one person lost, I think, 9 kilos in weight in 10 days. And that must be water. You can't lose that. Yeah, you can't lose that much. He had very swollen ankles. But they cured on that. But anyway, the point was he'd lost. He said, I'm weeing and weeing. So we had these mysteries, which was blood pressure improving, the need for more salt because they were getting muscle cramps, particularly the runners like me, and this weeing phenomenon. I was intrigued, so intrigued, and it took me 2 years to get to the bottom of it. And it turns out, you're right, insulin causes you to hoard salt. It stops the kidneys. It stops the kidneys from weeing out the salt as they would normally. So if you're diabetic and you have a high carbohydrate, a high sugary diet, you have high insulin holding on to that salt. Then when you go low carb, as I did, the insulin levels fall, and you then get rid of the salt you've previously been hoarding. And with the salt goes water, you lose volume, and the blood pressure improves. So that's, I do a separate series of talks on the fact that we are blaming sugar for what the salt, so it's the other way around, we're blaming salt for what the sugar did. And in fact, the physiology of that has been known since 1997. There were RCTs on this, well known, but there's no money to be made from it. So that was the second, or on to the third unexpected thing.
Well, I'm not sure what I say, because isn't that topic of the paper next year? There is another
question. No, that's a secret. We can't tell that. We could go on to another one. I think another criticism is that it's a middle class thing. And that only rich middle class people can afford to live on Parma ham and wild smoked salmon. And the wonderful group, so we're north of Liverpool, and there are people of many different incomes there.
Yeah.
But we're really not in a posh area with some very large council estates. And it was so interesting to actually ask the patients, the ones we look after, well, how, as somebody on a restricted income, what's it like, is low carb affordable? And what they said, which is really interesting, they said, depends how you look at it. If you're properly honest and include in your budget the money you were previously wasting on sugary drinks and snacks,
delivery pizzas,
and takeaway meals and all the rest, if you think of, you know, the cost of a takeaway pizza or whatever, if you include all of that in your budget, the budget on low carb can be about the same. But you're buying quality ingredients. And then the next thing they said, well, mince doesn't have to be big. Mince isn't expensive. Calorie for calorie, olive oil isn't expensive. In fact, butter and cream, eggs are a wonderful source. So I think that was the, I wrote in the Daily Mail on that because I felt it was so important. And Ali, you've done your book, which is why that's how we got, because we approved of what you did, because you were trying. Why, you know, should only rich people be the only ones to really enjoy their food? That's a horrible idea.
Yeah, and in the group, what was great is that people swapped just local knowledge as well. You know, Lidl's got the almonds that are cheap, or you can get the frozen.
Yeah, the frozen berries.
Frozen berries are only £1.50 in Iceland. So they'd share all that, and they'd also swap recipes, or we'd sort of when we could meet in person, which we can't at the moment. Obviously, I would always cook something and take something, show them how to make something really simple.
We did soup making for the whole group. How fast can you make soup?
We'd always, if there were new recipe books, we'd always take them to show. So there was a big emphasis on, how you do it, how do you make it sustainable and delicious, and where do you source your ingredients, that kind of thing.
Isn't it an interesting theme? The theme of stuff you thought before and that you no longer think. And all of us in this world, the low carb world, are so struck by, is breakfast the most important meal? No, I haven't eaten breakfast for years. Particularly people with diabetes, because of what's called the dawn phenomenon, have a higher blood sugar in the morning. So the last thing you need is a bowl of cornflakes if you have type 2 diabetes. And then there's a whole load of other things like, eat small, frequent meals for weight loss. Do you know, I haven't seen that work very often. Now I only eat once or twice a day. And that's for you. You never lost weight by frequent small meals.
Or by going low fat. Or by cutting salt down. Or any of the sort of traditional, it's just as if one kind of, one piece of the advice that certainly I'd been given in my adult lifetime seemed to kind of fall after another. And then there seemed to be hardly anything left of what I'd done before. It was as if I had to do a complete 360 to finally regain my own health. And that, and looking into all the science of that and the background to that, it's just been so eye-opening, really, and kind of mind-boggling that then you get that you can't think why anybody still thinks the original advice, because we're so steeped in it now. Yeah. If somebody, our daughter's just been in hospital, thrown it away now, but she came home with the advice leaflet of what to eat when she came out of hospital, and it was quite scary. There was quite a lot of tea cakes and biscuits and things like that on the,
Very little protein,
very little full fat, dairy, anything like that. So obviously we quickly got her on her rehab regime here, and she's
good. I'm glad she's making a full recovery.
Yes, she made a full recovery. Yeah.
I mean, it's such an amazing story. I kind of became aware of the work that you're doing in Southport in 2016. And I've been following it ever since. And like you say, it's been a learning curve, both in terms of reading stuff from around the world that other doctors are doing, or ordinary people who are trying it for themselves.
And I'm moving because the sun's on my face. Carry on there.
Sure, no probs. And in terms of what you're learning by working with the now 300 or so patients in your town, and I love all the stuff that you've learned and showed, and it's really interesting how much vitriol you got at the start, and really, opposition from people who should know better. at very high levels. And I think we can be classy enough not to name any names or point any fingers, but I love what you said in a recent talk, David, which was, if there is a risk, can someone tell me where it is?
Yeah.
And so you've got to this stage now where you've built up a cohort of 300 or so, and you've been very communicative with the world about all the things that seem to work, whether it's the component of community, whether it's the you know, various different types of food and recipes, and also how to get people off the drugs that they've been on for years, which is obviously something that's important to work with a doctor on. And you know, where are you working? What are you both doing at the moment to press ahead with all of these plans?
Who's going first?
You can go first.
Okay, I can go first. Well, so my the thing that I've got more and more interested in, both because it's kind of personally salient, but also I think it's something that the low carb community could embrace a bit more. Really, is the whole idea of the proportion of people who are sugar addicted or food addicted, because it seems to me that the kind of subgroup that needs slightly special treatment, that, you know, a lot of people do really benefit from low carb, but some people can't, some people do struggle to maintain it actually, and will come sort of spectacularly off the wagon, and you know, may come back later on, and it's possible that that like me, they have that lifelong struggle with moderating anything to do with sugar or carbohydrates at all. And although it's not strictly recognised as a condition, that's something I'm getting interested in. In a way, advocating for that there should be more research into it, that there are a lot of people around who genuinely suffer from a condition that looks extremely like addiction when it comes to sugar and carbohydrate and junk food, and that if that's the case, then we should look at it in the light of how we help people with other addictions. And the sort of fundamental to that is we can't do moderation. You wouldn't just tell an alcoholic to have one glass of whiskey because it's his birthday, like people always say to you, don't they, when you're low carb, or you can have a bit of cake, it's your birthday. Maybe some people can, but there are a proportion of people, and we've certainly got them in the group as well. And now I've been training with Bitten Johnson, who you might have heard of, who's over in Sweden, who's, you know, really internationally known in this. A true food sugar addict can't do moderation, can't do one slice of cake, because we'll wait till everybody goes home and then we'll eat the rest of it. So the abstinence becomes the kind of key message, if you like. And also in terms of sugar addiction, people can't do keto cupcakes, they can't do sweeteners. You know, so it's a kind of slightly different way of looking at it. So I'm strongly into that's occupying a lot of my thinking at the moment.
That's great.
Yeah.
I had Agnes Ayton and Ali Ibrahim on talking about that very topic. You know, it was great to hear an eminent consultant psychiatrist in.
We really like her a lot.
We love Agnes.
The world is lucky to have her.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's
real towering integrity.
There's a couple of people in the States as well. I mean, there are people, but it is still very controversial as a topic. And again, you know, for whatever reason, there's some quite vociferous voices that say that it doesn't exist. And I think we can all probably guess why they might say that. But so it's a really interesting area to get into.
And that really, you know, the people that say that food addiction doesn't exist, it upsets me really, because I have so many patients who maybe weigh 25 stone, And they know they cannot moderate bread or whatever it is. So really, if food addiction does not exist, those people are left with the assumption that they are mad. And I know they're not mad, and that food addiction helps them have a model that understands what they have done. And then to tell them that food addiction cannot be true, that's so hard on those people who cannot control. And I've a large number of people who cannot control their carbohydrate intake. They really can't. So we shouldn't be blaming them. That's the point. This isn't about fat blaming, fat shaming. Addiction gives them a model that they can forgive themselves, which is the first thing. And then the second thing, if you can understand yourself, if you know what the problem is, again, you are nearer to finding its solution. But if we deny patients any understanding of their behavior, how can they ever escape the tyranny? And I saw Jen, her weight, all her life has bounced up and down by about 3 stones as she's tried one diet after another. And she was unhappy when she's a bigger woman. Genuinely unhappy. So anyway, that I support Jen. I believe food addiction is a problem, that we should investigate it and try and help people.
That's great. And I think, you know, so that I think that side of it is only gonna grow, because it's got the ring of truth about it. So you were talking about a paper before we started recording, David. Has that kind of been your main focus recently?
My thing is I really want the world to know that drug-free type 2 diabetes remission is a completely reasonable goal for people with type 2 diabetes. I mean, I didn't know it was, so for many years, and until I'd never met a single person who would achieve this until 2012. But now I've got 80, we have 85 people in the practice who've achieved a normal blood sugar with no drugs. And that is so inspiring for people with type 2 diabetes. It gives them hope. And Jen has taught me that hope is so important, so important. And yet I know that for the average person with type 2 diabetes, nobody mentions drug-free remission to them. And yet you can change their lives. So my commitment is I'm trying to show mainly healthcare professionals. I'm trying to say, if we can have 85 people in drug-free type 2 diabetes remission north of Liverpool in an NHS practice, and it's growing, so you can do it too. So I have to think, how am I to get the message out? And I've discovered that if you're to be taken seriously, you have to publish papers. So Jen and I have now, we've probably published, maybe it's about 9 papers. But next week I've got the biggie, my magnum opus coming out, which is the 6-year data at Norwood. So we've looked at what happened to the NHS patients over 6 years in terms of blood sugar, blood pressure, lipid profile, and the amount of money we're spending on drugs. And so next week I have a paper coming out in BMJ Nutrition, jointly written with a professor of nutrition from Cambridge University. So we're so lucky, and Jen's a co-author. What I was telling you before is the agony that is publishing. So people always wonder why, you know, if clinicians have good data, why don't they publish? And I'm always being told, oh, well, why don't you publish? And the reason we don't publish usually is the huge amount of work. So I will have written 305 separate Word documents to produce this one paper over a year. So it's nearly a Word document every single day of the year for a year to get published. It's agony. And it's criticized and it's pulled to pieces, and then there's trouble. It's like, it's really giving birth to a baby, this, and it's being published next week. I shall be tweeting all about it, because I'm hoping it will generate interest. I'm hoping it will demonstrate that type 2 diabetes remission in the NHS is perfectly feasible and sustainable, because at that point, so for the for the people in the data we've collected, the average time they've been on a low carb diet was about 2 years. So this is some of the best data that are most comprehensive, not, I don't know where the best is right, but it's most comprehensive data published. And the results are as good as any clinic in the world. And so if we can do this in the NHS, how brilliant. So that's my big thing paper. And then I've got another secret paper that I can't tell you about for afterwards. That one. It's good.
Chopping down another one of the main criticisms.
It's another big criticism, but I'm not going to tell you because I don't want somebody to pinch my idea before I've got. That's another baby that could be strangled in its crib.
Well, I can't wait. I
have a car accident or, you know, I'm found drowned in the bath.
Well, I can't wait to read the paper that's definitely coming out.
I hope you will,
Jay. And that's brilliant. I think that's such a point that most people don't appreciate, is that all this stuff takes so much time out of busy people's lives. There's not a lot of joined up thinking between the disciplines, and you know I think people assume that because we live in a technological society that we live in a fully realized society, but in many ways we're in the dark ages, and it just still takes a lot of time to get
most people who can write the papers are in academic jobs.
Well, Jen was
and then of course they're not always clinicians, so they can do an amazing kind of RCT or some kind of clever thing, but does it then actually apply in real life practice? So at least this is the other way around. Like, we know that whatever it is that we're doing at Norwood, it does actually work in real life practice. And I think the other problem is that a lot of research is funded by the drug companies. And of course, this is who would ever fund a study into low carb?
Well, particularly in our practice, because we're spending £50,000 per year less on drugs for diabetes alone.
This is what I was going to say is, you know, obviously,
which drug company is going to think that I'm, you know, that's a great idea and they want me silenced. They don't want me chatting on.
Well, but, you know, if you had to sort of coldly assess the benefits, I would talk about the improved quality of life years, which is how most of these public health academics, you know, like, for example, there's been a few that have been on the podcast, Grant Schofield, Sylvia Carpegum, these types of academics. Quality of life years is a way to quantify improvements in people's lives. And obviously, to me, that's the main thing. You're talking about people having a brightness in their eyes, they're living longer and they're living better, which is the main thing. But
it is.
It's also telling people of any political stripe that you can save the NHS per practice, per GP practice, never mind not amputating diabetic limbs anymore, never mind all the other surgical burdens and hospital burdens, £50,000 plus per year just in diabetes drugs, never mind the other GP-based care that isn't going to be required. I mean, the savings could be astronomical.
Well, actually, we've done the sums, or somebody else did it for us. So every GP, our prescribing is monitored by a wonderful website called openprescribing.net, the brainchild of Ben Goldacre, who you may have heard of. Ben Goldacre.
Love his book and his column, Bad Science.
Yeah, he's great. So that's how I know about our prescribing. But also a member of the public contacted me, and they'd done all the sums on the data from open prescribing. And if every GP in the country, just as regards type 2 diabetes, prescribed as I do, it would save £270 million per year, which would fund a wonderful diabetes service. And so we're not paid for doing this. We have to look after people with diabetes anyway. But that's just as you say, the drugs is only part of it. What about the amputations? What about the suffering and the outpatient appointments and the
blood pressure?
Well, we know now. Well, let's go to COVID. We know that the factors that really are important, the cofactors within COVID, which make the difference between being in hospital or not, or being on a ventilator or not, interestingly, are obesity, central obesity, blood pressure, and quality of diabetic control. And so low carb actually deals, as I've just said, with blood pressure. It deals with obesity. They lose on average 9 kilos. And the diabetic control improves. So another one of my themes at the moment is we keep talking about protecting the vulnerable, which I agree, we should protect the vulnerable with COVID. But that has the effect of scaring them half to death because they're all locked away in their homes thinking they could die. My mother's quite, she's 85 with diabetes. She's really frightened. But shouldn't we be talking about making them less vulnerable and using this time to give them hints as to how they can help themselves? And nutrition can make a massive difference, in my opinion, to how vulnerable you are to COVID. So that was a sudden thing I just thought then.
Absolutely. And I think that might be a great place to wrap it up. You know, it's very inspiring and current as well. And it's been really great talking to you. I mean, maybe you could just say where you want people to find you online and we can leave it there.
Yeah.
So I'm mostly found stalking around on Twitter at Jen_Unwin. I have got a website coming soon, which is going to be all about food and sugar addiction. And it's going to be called aforkintheroad.co.uk.
And I'm at Low Carb GP. And I'm on most days, and I try
on Twitter.
And I try and bounce around anything I think would be useful to the community. Thanks.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.